So good to be with you this morning and have this opportunity to take a different look, I think, at a very important foundation of our faith. In the bulletin, if you've got it, on page 7, a place to keep track of what we're going to talk about this morning, and you might be benefited by being able to write these things down, because they do not lend easily to be remembered, I think, this criteria. We're going to get a little technical this morning as we continue with our theme of the year, Things Most Surely Believed. This theme comes from Luke chapter 1, verse 1, reading from the English Standard Version, the version that's in the Pew Bible. Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you may have certainty concerning the things you have been taught. The King James is the one from which the version is from which we take the theme for the year, Things Most Surely Believed Among Us. But the idea, not just of belief in terms of how we receive it, but that these things have been accomplished. These are most certainly true. And there is a firm foundation for these things. And what in our fourth lesson on this series, we devote every first Sunday of each month to considering our theme. I want to talk today about the gospel accounts, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, this foundation of the relating of the life of Jesus, the ministry of Jesus. I want to talk about the gospels. Most of us accept them for what the Bible claims they are. In 2 Timothy chapter 3, verses 16 and 17, all scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, and for correction and instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be perfect, thoroughly furnished to every good work. Or in 2 Peter chapter 1, as was read in the introductory Bible reading, that they didn't relate to us things that they had made up in the corner and cunningly put together. Rather, they had been eyewitnesses of these things, and these things were most certainly established. I want to talk about the certainty with which we know these Gospels really happen and are relating to us truth. And so the question that I'll give you at the start is, if you were now not talking about anything religious, if you were just a student of history and you wanted to try to validate something that you heard about happening in antiquity, how do you go about that? You're studying the Vikings and you hear about Eric the Red and you think, how can I be sure he was real? You're studying ancient China and you want to know about some of the dynasties. How can you be sure they actually existed and they're not just mythological? You want to study the Greco-Roman history. How do you know someone real was real, or if they were just some made-up figure? How do you do that? And how do you do that with certainty? First of all, let me tell you, that not everybody's concerned with establishing the truth of what they understand and what they teach. In the news this past week, I noticed an article that Louis Farrakhan had in mid-February made a talk, and in that talk, he said that God doesn't love this world. God didn't send his son to this world. Jesus did not die on Calvary. He died in front of a closed store that was boarded up that was owned by a Jew. And the Romans took him up to Calvary. Obviously, Louis Farrakhan is not too much concerned with proofing his facts and finding what is true. And lots of folks are that way. To those who do not care to investigate and mine for the truth and are willing to believe a lie, and to those who listen to those who would put lies forth, God render unto them according to their works and what they do. I hope you're not of that ilk. I hope you're not sitting and blindly receiving whatever is said. More nobly, like the Bereans were more noble than those in Thessalonica, that they received the word with all readiness of heart, but they searched the scriptures to see if those things were so. That's how you need to be. And just in general, having to care enough to find the truth. Go back to the sermon from 2 weeks ago about truth and see how important it is that we love it and that we're willing to fight for it, willing to look for it. Let's not just talk about religion, though, as we're going forth here. Let me give you some of the criteria that secular historians use to try to determine whether or not something from antiquity is true. The first thing is, if they can find very early eyewitness testimony, that says a lot. The idea is, the longer after an event occurs that there's a witness from it, the more likely that witness's statement is not the best, not true. But if we can find somebody close to the event who was there, who saw it, and then wrote quickly after what they saw, that gives us credence and that validates whatever event we're trying to look at. Multiple independent attestation. What do I mean? A lot of sources that are confirming the same thing. In our world today, I don't know if you've noticed this, but have you ever anybody listen to AM and FM radio anymore? I don't know. But if you're listening to the radio and you hear a news item in the news today that it cured cancer, you go, well, I heard it on the radio. I think I might need to check that out. And you get to the work and you look up on the internet and you find somebody says, well, they've cured cancer. And then you, on the news that night, it says on the TV, they've cured cancer. And you go, well, I've got three different sources that's confirming they've cured cancer. Chances are what happened is they all were reading the same article, maybe something put out by the AMA. And so really you've only got one source for that. It's just been picked up by the radio and then by the internet and then by the TV. That can happen now in these days especially, not so much in the old days, but can you find different people, multiple, independent? They were not talking to one another. They were not interrelated. They're individually saying the same thing and validating the same event. That gives us credence to that event as well. Dissimilarity, and this especially if someone is presenting an idea and claiming that it is their own. For instance, in the area of mathematics or in the area of some sort of other philosophy. If someone is presenting an idea and you look at the record and you've never heard anybody say that before, and it starts with this individual, if it's not like anything you've heard before, if it's original, chances are it started with them. And that's another thing that validates teaching, especially. Embarrassment. The idea, I think, here underlying this is, if somebody's going to write something and create something, they're not going to write something that embarrasses them. And if you find something that supports an event that is in some way embarrassing, that is more to be believed and that is more credible than something that is just flattering. Embarrassment tends to lend credence to an event's description. Enemy attestation. If you can find an enemy saying, yeah, that happened, someone who's not on the team, but rather on the other team, and they say that an event happened, that lends credence to whatever is being talked about. And finally, coherence. If the different tellings by these multiple independent attesters, if they cohere, if they agree, and we get a similar telling, then that lends credence to the idea that the event actually happened as described. So here's a list of six different criteria. It's not an exhaustive list, but it's just generally what historians would do to try to investigate if something is real, if something really happened. Like if you're just trying to see, did Julius Caesar ever really live? you could apply these different criteria and come up with some sort of evaluation. When it comes to early eyewitness testimony, there were two contemporaries of Caesar who spoke, Cicero and Sallust, and they wrote and they corroborated that Caesar was a person. They described him, and it was early, it was eyewitness testimony. And that's pretty good. Two different sources related, you know, that were contemporaries writing about him, that gives credence to the fact that he was a real person. Hundred years later, both Suetonius and Plutarch wrote, and they talked about him. Now, they're writing 100 years later, but they wrote about Julius Caesar, and that makes us think that, yeah, he was a real person. Multiple independent attestations. I just said we had a number of different authors who weren't speaking to one another who wrote about him. That is important. Forget the dissimilarity at this point, but moving on to embarrassment, a number of authors that talk about him say that there were rumors of him being a homosexual. That's an embarrassing thing, but it's listed in there, and so we think, well, that's probably true because it was listed by a number of different folks, and it probably leads to the credibility that he was an actual person. Enemy attestation. If you've got a person that's saying, you know what, I hated Caesar. He was an awful guy, but he was a good general. And another guy says, well, I really didn't like the clothes that he wore, but he was a good general. If you've got these people that don't care for him, but they say he was a good general, he was probably a good general. And so enemy attestation can support that. And then coherence. Do all these different versions by Cicero and Plutarch, do they all agree and cover the same kinds of events? That would lend credence. So Caesar measures up very well. And we have, we take him as being a true historical person. I say all that to say this, dear ones. How do the Gospels measure up to this kind of inspection? How do the gospel accounts measure up to this kind of validation? And I'll tell you that they measure up absolutely wonderfully, maybe better than any other truth coming out of antiquity. First of all, in the area of early eyewitness testimony, we've got these people who in Acts chapter 1 are identified, the apostles, as being those who were with Jesus from the time of John's baptism in the Jordan to the time of his crucifixion. That was a criteria for apostles. These are the ones from whom these testimonies are coming, these early eyewitness testimonies. And we've got these accounts dating back, the earliest, which we understand as being Mark's, probably about 30 years after the event. Eyewitnesses 30 years after the event are writing about this, and then John, one of the later ones to come out, but even still, probably within 60 years after the event, John has written his. And so we have wonderful early eyewitness testimony of the life of Jesus. That's what the Gospels are. Multiple independent attestation. You would say probably that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John give us four different attestations to the life of Jesus. That's true. Actually, the scholars that look at that say that there are five different sources in there, but that's a pretty technical concept that I don't think I want to go into with you this morning. But besides the gospel accounts, we've got so many early church fathers, we call them, early church historians writing, even at the close of the first century, referring to the gospel accounts. There is multiple independent attestation that these are historical records of historical events. Dissimilarity. There's an amazing thing that comes out of this with reference to how Jesus referred to himself. Jesus referred to himself very often as the Son of Man. We find a record of that being mentioned in Daniel chapter 7, I believe it is, the idea of the Son of Man and how important that is. But the Jews never referred to Jesus as the Son of Man. And you know what? The New Testament writers, besides the Gospel writers, didn't refer to Jesus as the Son of Man. Jesus referred to himself as the Son of Man. It's a very new and very unusual concept he says about himself, and it is a strong attestation that he is the Son of God. And so an amazing support for the idea of Jesus being the Son of Man, Son of God, from his own testimony. Embarrassment. There are so many things in the Gospels that are embarrassing. If you were going to write it, you wouldn't have written it that way. The idea that the empty tomb was discovered by women, they were not the most credible witnesses in that day. And you would have probably, if you were inventing that, had somebody else go there and find the tomb empty first. The idea that Peter, one of the principal disciples, would say, "I'm going to follow you to the death," and then immediately deny him. He probably wouldn't have put that in. He probably wouldn't have had one that he chose be the one that would betray him. But Judas Iscariot, one of the 12, was the one that betrayed him. Very interesting also, in Mark chapter 3, talks about James, or the family of Jesus. When Jesus was teaching who he was, he says his family thought he was crazy. His family thought he was nuts. James went on to be one of the principal players in the New Testament times in the church in Jerusalem. It's embarrassing that your family thinks you're crazy when you're getting started in your ministry. Enemy attestation. So many of the amazing deeds that Jesus did were done in the presence of enemies. And when his enemies said, he did that by the power of Beelzebub, thank you very much. You just validated that he did a miracle, even though you tried to blame it on something else or attribute it to some other factor. Enemies attested that Jesus was doing amazing things. "Truly, this man does many signs," they said in one place. And they decided, because of that, to kill him. They could not deny that he was doing amazing things. And then finally, the coherence. Some folks will make a big deal out of some seemingly contradictory facts that are presented in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But those books cohere very well. And as a matter of fact, if they agreed 100%, you'd be suspicious that maybe they got together and colluded. But I think sometimes we just see four different perspectives, four different versions of the same thing, and we see great coherence in the gospel accounts. I appreciate you listening, dear ones. I hope this has been helpful to you. This is such an important thing. There is such a foundation for what we have received. And we might think sometimes, well, you either just believe or you don't. Or maybe you just believe because you were raised in a country where they teach these things. If you had been raised in Saudi Arabia, you'd believe something else. These are powerful truths that have been firmly established, that are most certainly believed, they were most certainly accomplished, and they stand the closest scrutiny, and they stand the test of time, and they call us to respond to them by believing them, by accepting them, by being saved by them, and by teaching them to others. We always make a time when we're together to get right,